Hi everyone, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Alright, I've been, just to update you, I do have a podcast now. It's available in several places. I put up a video earlier with several links. Not all of them were up there, so I'm going to revise that video and put it up again for you with a list of all of the links. Including, it's taking a while. iHeartRadio is taking their sweet time approving the video. But you can get it directly from Podbean. I think it's buddhahood.podbean.com. That takes you directly to my podcast webpage. But you can also get it through Spotify, through, what was the other ones? Anyway, there's so many now. I'm a little behind the times on that. But at any rate, Buddhahood Podcast is the name, the Buddhahood Podcast. Wow, didn't know that was so hard to say. Is now available several places, including Apple. Anyway, I started a video, and this is for you who are following me on my YouTube channel, with a video on, what was it called? I think Conditioned Genesis. So I wanted to answer this question that I've answered several times. It's about the Nidana. It's an early concept in Buddhism. And it really deals with Buddha's intuition on the nature of life, including the universe. So it's really an important concept. And then recently, I've been in discussions with another question that's come up a lot, is the three bodies of Buddha. The manifest body, the reward body, and the Dharma body. And as usual, Buddhism is an old form of teachings, almost, going on 3,000 years, 2,700 years. So you can imagine that the way people learned things was very different in those days. And there were very different echelons in the society, castes they were called in India and in other places as well. So if you were of a lower caste, education just wasn't, it was a daily experience of survival. That was your education, in other words. And merchants had some education in counting, money, trade, those kinds of things. Very business knowledge, one-to-one relationship knowledge. If you will. And then you had, and by no means are there only three castes, but I'm dividing it this way just as an illustration. You have a very upper, quote-unquote, caste, as we do in all societies, really. This is just human. Some humans are much more interested and therefore often given the responsibility for things like text, language, and history, and conceptual knowledge. Like today, we have scientists, and then we have teachers, and then we have students, and then we have, all the way to farmers and merchants, and down to just the worker bees, right? And so on. So there are different levels or castes classes of people, and certainly the divisions the further back you go in history are a little bit more stark, and so teaching, which Shakyamuni's goal was to teach all people irrespective of caste Buddhism, and how to make their lives create more value in their lives, create more stability in their lives, create less fear in their lives. In short, the perturbations of life, which is often quoted or translated to be sufferings. But sufferings, you know, it's a word that can have meanings individual to people in different classes, right? So sufferings to some people is just outright pain. That's an equal sign between those two words. But then you got to ask yourself, well, what kind of pain? Physical pain, emotional pain, psychological pain, right? So there are various descriptions that fall under this great umbrella of sufferings. That's why perturbations, or maybe it's a better word, but not everybody is aware of what that word means. So you get into this language problem, right? And I bring that up because in trying to, after part one, I really started wondering how much value there would be in me repeating with maybe different sentence structures, but largely the same language, the same vernacular, this idea of the Nidana and the origins of life, really, because they're the origins of everything. And this is what Buddha was trying to teach to people who had never, they didn't even know what writing was, let alone a book, right? So this is why he taught verbally. He didn't write anything down. So here's the problem. How do you teach this profound concept of the formation of the universe, the formation of matter, the formation of time, the formation of life itself, all the way down to your fingernails, and they are related, they are essentially the same thing. How do you help somebody grasp these immense concepts who have never been exposed to anything scientific or mercantile, or, you know, take the lowest common denominator of people who are not professionals and not part of the class that learns how to read, write, and language and so forth. It's like teaching a child. And how do we do that still to this day? We do it with stories. We give them, even if they're not, we use actual examples from life, but this is a concept that transcends this immediacy, physical immediacy, if you will, of experience. So how do we translate these concepts, these complicated, profound concepts, in stories? Well, like many things, the stories become kind of fabled, imaginative. We create characters that are relatable, and we put them in situations, and that explains a different kind of a thought. So all of them become thought experiments, thought expressions, and thoughts of all sorts of words are going through my mind. But see, this is the problem with language. I'm not sure how a word will come across depending on what someone's particular experience of life is, right? So anyway, I was obsessing about this when I was about to do part two, and I thought, you know what? I don't want to repeat myself because I've gone ad nauseum in depth on these concepts in previous videos. I was starting to hear myself repeat the same things, and I thought, well, Sylvain, you've got to think of a different way to talk about this. You know, you've fallen into what for me, for myself, is familiar territory, but my experience has a lot of science and math and astronomy and physics and that world. That's part of my experience, but it's not part of everyone's experience. And I find this in daily life, explaining concepts, and I'll use words that are unfamiliar to others, and it completely drops them out of the flow of information. So that's my mission, as I've stated before, is to make Buddhism more accessible, more relatable, more easily understood. I've got the same burden in a way on my shoulders. I'm not comparing myself directly to Shakyamuni Buddha or Nichiren or Tendai, but the nature of the mission is the same. It's a bodhisattva mission, and it requires of me to stretch out of my known universe and reinvestigate things, and forcing a different perspective, even though it's still ultimately mine. It's a mental exercise, just like Buddhism is, right? And so I came up with a couple of things that actually taught me something. And just as an aside note, maybe I should stand like this. this is very much what Buddhism is about. The Mahayana school says it's all well and good to practice for your own enlightenment, but until you reach outside of yourself to other human beings and have a dialogue with them at whatever level they may be, to talk about Buddhism and to nurture them to look further into it, there are parts of your known self that you don't know. In other words, you don't experience. And so that's really an encumbrance. I'll sit like this now. An encumbrance to your enlightenment, your full enlightenment, right? So this is the bodhisattva aspect of Mahayana Buddhism. You must reach outside of yourself in order to catapult your enlightenment and grow your experience of awakening fully. So I put myself to task, didn't I? And I had several different ways of doing this. And the more I did it, the more I searched, the more I found that the three bodies of Buddha, the Nidana, the origins of life, all of these things started to be the same discussion. And I thought, well, isn't that fascinating? Once again, I'm confronted with the evidence of the steps of Buddhist teaching. Because this is what happens with all of Buddhist concepts. They start from a point where you can see these different concepts at their foundation, and the more you move along the sutras and commentaries to the days of Tendai and then Dengyo and then Nichiren, it is only when you get to the Lotus Sutra and Nichiren's elucidation of the Lotus Sutra that the aha moments just start to come. They just one after another, and you can see how the concepts that are referenced in a very compact nature and more profound even in the Lotus Sutra have their foundations in earlier teachings. And then when you read those earlier teachings again, wow, it hits you. Oh, I didn't really get this. I thought I got it. But now that I know all of these things, and I see where it's going, where the destination is. Oh, that's why he said this. That's how he said that. Enough of that. So where was I? Oh, yes. Okay. So the same thing happened with the concepts of Nidana, very early concept, followed quickly by the three bodies of the Buddha. And then we get to the 3,000 realms in a single moment. And enlightenment, awakening, being finally in the Lotus Sutra, a property of life. Not another place, another thing, but an actual component that's fundamental, that we can awaken to in this life at this moment, because it's been there all along. Wow, this big circular thing starts to happen, right? So this is what I want to try to do in part two. Really might seem like a whole different video, but I think this is how I want to approach these questions, the three bodies and Nidana and the 3,000 realms and inherent Buddha nature. So the first thought that came to me was, you know, I'm always doing analogies. So I woke up, as I do several times during the night, and I thought, I think there's something to this that people would understand in sport or in any kind of physical competitive thing. And I thought, what if we talk about a gal, a girl, named, I don't know, let's call her Donna. And Donna, as a very early in childhood, you know, before puberty, she really likes competition, but not competition egotistically so much as a way to excel. She likes running. She likes, you know, she's an aggressive player. She's not a passive player, I would say. So she likes to get involved, and she likes the physicality, and she likes the way it makes her feel, right? And without breaking it down much more than that, my simple example is simply this. As she grows up, she gets involved in more and more sports, and maybe she loves tennis. I'm just on the spot making this up, right? I was thinking of baseball before, but let's use tennis. And here's the reason why. Because she can play tennis at some level all her life. It's a great avocation, right? And she can be, you know, this a hobby, I guess would be the word, tennis. And, you know, she goes through spurts. If she can, if she does well in life, maybe she buys all the togs and all the accoutrements of tennis and all, and she really gets into it. But, you know, she's just an avid tennis player at that point. But let's say at a rather young age, as a teenager, she finds that she can't stop thinking about tennis, that this is everything to her. She really wants to get good at tennis. Well, the first step is she's got to learn the rules, right? And then she's got to become proficient at the actualization of the sport. She has to physically develop. And at some point, she's going to develop her knowledge, her strategy, go way beyond the rules and simple movements, but strategy for becoming a very competitive player in tennis. Then she kind of leaves a large group of tennis players behind, right? She becomes a different kind of a tennis player. And let's say she wants to pursue this into the Olympics or, you know, the world stage. She then has to really 24/7 has to hone her skills. Oh, and by the way, guess what? She can't really do this on her own, can she? She can only go so far with a backboard and running around the court and learning all there is to know. She really won't know everything all there is to know until she actually plays other people. I'm sure you're making connections already, right? So, when she reaches the pinnacle, she wins championships, she wins the Olympics, or she just competes in the Olympics. She's now a tennis player. She's fully actualized. But now, something else happens in this timeline. At first, tennis is something she's kind of obsessive about, but she's got to do her math homework, and she's got to do chores around the house, and she's got to satisfy family responsibilities, and blah, 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 blah. As she dedicates more and more of her life to this, and I saw this in a girlfriend I had in my teens who was an ice skater. Anyway, strange aside, but so now she gets competitive in tennis. Now her life is really revolves around tennis. Everything else that she does, and she does do other things, Donna has to socialize. She has to have a life outside of tennis. But everything starts to be described in tennis-like terms, right? When she has a heavy discussion with somebody, they volley, right? And she starts to think of the kill shot or the spike. Won that argument, or maybe it's something else. Pick your analogy there. But you can see it starts to really take over her life. And then at some point, she only can think in terms of tennis. Her relationships in life, her opportunity. When you become a major tennis player, yes, tennis is your life, but you also have sponsors and magazines and interviews, and so everything in her head is completely consumed by what she's pushed her body and mind to do, and that is to be a competitive, winning tennis player, right? And so I wanted to show the analogy of that, not only as a really rough idea of nidana, how one thing begets another thing, and they build on one another, but also the three bodies of Buddha. Because at first, she's a little girl who learns how to play tennis. She's manifest. She's a little girl. And she has a will, a conviction, right? And she's in samsara. But this is one level of manifestation. This is her human manifestation. But it equates to the Buddha manifestation body. And you'll understand why in a moment or a little later. The next step is she becomes a great tennis player. She's taken tennis on as her practice and study. And she's achieved being a great tennis player. This is her reward body. Right? And then when she gets to the point, the pinnacle of tennis, her entire life revolving around tennis and affecting every aspect of her life, in that moment, if she chooses to, she can realize, and you've heard sports people. Or any business, if you think of it, when they reach a pinnacle of success in it, will say to you, "I knew I wanted to do this ever since I was a little dot dot dot. I always knew I would dot dot dot." Not everyone, but that's pretty common, isn't it? But that's not because they knew that to begin with. They may say that, they may use those words, but it's because from their position now, they look back and they look with a wry smile, kind of like they're telling themselves, really, I was headed here all along. But that's not true as a human. You can see, though, a definite line through your life experiences taking you where you are. And it's the same with your Buddhist practice. When you awaken, everything that you did that got you to your awakening, whether it was related to Buddhism or not, suddenly appears very obviously connected. And in that moment is when you look back at your manifestation, when Donna looks back at herself at age six and sees Buddha or sees championship tennis player. She didn't know it then. She didn't even know what that looked like, felt like, smelled like, thought like. But she does now. And now she can look back to herself as a 6-year-old and say, I was meant to do this. I was manifested tennis queen. And by the way, the fact that I'm here and I now know this is my reward. See, it all happens at the same time. Buddha's three bodies aren't distinct bodies. They are distinct aspects of who he is, the Buddha, because he's already there. And now he recognizes the Buddha manifest, the Buddha reward, and the Buddha Dharma. Because the Dharma is the whole thing. And what is the whole thing? 3,000 realms, Nidana, the origin of life, this universe, these universes, what the universe came of. And I've talked about all of that through older videos on the origins of life, the 3,000 realms. This is all very circular, very connected. And so that's the overarching point I want to make in this part two, is that we all tend to compartmentalize all these different aspects of Buddhism, but they're really all talking about the exact same thing. That's why we need to study, because at some point these insights are going to come to you in your own way, through your own experience of life, and you're going to read and learn enough things over and over again in different ways. They're going to seem like all different things, but at some point they're going to start connecting one by one. Oh, that relates to that. Oh, now I get it. And then that and that and that. Oh, that relates to that. Oh. And at some point, you're just going to sit back and go, I was meant to do this. Ta-da! So, I don't know, it may be a sloppy analogy, but I had to try a different way to get there. Now I want to introduce another one. I'm going to put a picture up on this video. I want you to look at it and consider what you're looking at. That sports analogy, the tennis analogy I just made, it's a very earthbound human thing, right? Well, so is this, but from a different perspective. So we look at there are several images, and I'll put a flurry of them up before this video ends. There's especially a timeline that I find fascinating, and you can download it yourself. I'll put links. Hopefully I'll be able to find them all, put links. But there's one very long timeline of the universe that I find fascinating. Now, in my discussions on the 3,000 realms and the origins of life and that whole series, I go well beyond the Big Bang, because the obvious question is, what was before the Big Bang? So Buddhism answers that, believe it or not. I'll introduce a new term that I didn't know back then. With the introduction, with the introduction of these terms in the recent decades on what the universe, you know, the dark matter, dark energy that we hear a lot of from science, there's now an accepted term called the bulk, which fascinates me and makes me smile, because I've been talking about that bulk since I started talking about the 3,000 realms. You may remember my analogy of taking a drop of food coloring, like red dye, and dumping it into just one drop into a huge volume of water. And that drop, when it immediately hits the water, it starts to disperse, right? And it keeps dispersing until it just disappears into the water. Well, the water is the bulk. And that's what they're noticing about the universe, is that, you know, when we learned it as kids, it was, the universe was like a balloon, and it just kept expanding, and everything that was in the universe at this point is just further apart at this point. But if you think about the bulk, it's not a balloon at all. It's this point that expands into something. And that does a lot to explain that there's more stuff between the stuff we started out with, because there was stuff there to begin with, the bulk. We're talking now about energy, right? E equals mc squared. E also equals, I forget whose formulation this was, but an electromagnetism has a formula for E equals a frequency. So there's this is where a lot of field theories come from, right? Quantum fields and so forth. Anyway, so I'm going into that science area again. I'm going to stop myself, because I've already done that a bunch. But I just wanted to refer to it, because when you look at this diagram, that Big Bang is a moment of a huge amount of energy being released. You could easily equate this with what Shakyamuni was talking about as the beginning of this Nidana. But you can also look at it, and this is actual now. I wanted to distinguish what I'm talking about now is actual samsaric fact, okay? When you're looking at this diagram, this isn't a fanciful illustration. This is a very observed, because that's what science is, observation, truth, or if you don't like the word truth, actual experience in our material environment, including ourselves. So that big blast at the beginning where it says Big Bang, think of this as a thought moment. Why do we put light bulbs over our head and go, aha, I just got an idea. I've just illuminated an answer. We use this symbolism over and over and over again. But take it literally for a moment. 3,000 realms in a single thought moment. Bang. And what happens after this big bang? There's a huge release of energy. Super hot. Where there is no matter, there is only energy. As that energy just starts to slow, the heat starts to dissipate. It starts to cool at temperatures we can't hardly imagine. And energy starts to, because this is happening at a rate of speed we can't understand either. As things start to slow, just infinitesimally, matter starts to form. Little groups of energy start to coalesce into a different form, a formation. I'm going to throw Buddhist terms in here, so you start to follow this relationship. The formations lead to more and more complex formations, lead to material. Think of this backwards. Take an ice cube. Put it in a warmer environment. It turns into a liquid. Start to heat it. At some point it boils. What rises from the boiling water is vapor. Has water particulate, but it's carried by warmer air, cloud-like. Keep heating it, and a very clear, to our eyes, steam comes. See, the thing you see is water vapor. The thing you don't see is steam. That's hot, hot, hot. Water. Until the water gets so hot that it's hydrogen and oxygen. Until the hydrogen and oxygen gets so hot that it breaks down into its component things. Quarks, electrons, electromagnetism, a field. This is the other way around. So you start with these fields of energy that start to coalesce. Then you end up what's called the Dark Ages here, which obviously isn't the Knights of the Round Table, is that this energy stays in this uncoalesced state or very dispersed state, like steam, for a very long time until it finally starts to cool enough to start to make collections of gases being a more physical, more complex, more glued together energies and formations of energies into gases that then coalesce into, you know, our sun is just a big ball of reacting gases. It looks like a solid object. And in a way, you could argue that it is, because gases are atoms, molecules, right? But you get the point. And that stays with us for a very, very long time. Until enough cooling happens, enough distance between dispersity of these clumps start to cool and make more involved, more complex clumps that become eventually solid matter that develop their own conditions and tendencies around them, like Earth. And this will keep going on and turn into something else over time. And there's some charts that talk about this. That one long chart that looks like a little spectrograph until you expand it and start to see all the information in there is an amazing, amazing chart that goes from the origins of our universe to its logical future, projected, of course. So as you look at this, this I want you to see as a direct observation of Nidana. But it's also the three bodies. You have the 3,000 realms here, that thought moment producing all of these realms of experience. And from where we are at this point, we have a realization of what our manifestation, which was manifest in the Big Bang. But now, from our Earth perspective, we have the reward of seeing how we got here, right? And through discussion with one another, we can project where this is going, and our understanding now of where we are, how we got here, where we started. That's our dharma, our human dharma. You see how circular this is? Everything works this way. This is why Buddha said this practice, this method. When you get to Buddha, Buddha nature, Buddha mind, you will understand the nature of everything. So conditioned genesis, Nidana, 3,000 realms, defines a process. It doesn't define a truth from the remotest past to today. It defines a process, because the universe, too, is a product of this process. And so is your Buddhist practice. And so is your every single thought moment. The thought moments that create you, your perception of you. You is really a perception of everything that's happening and that you're experiencing. That's you, not this. This is just part of the process. Being earthbound is certainly a part of our experience, but it doesn't make you and me. You and me is the perception and experience that we have of being on Earth, which comes from all of that in the picture. I hope this is making more sense. I'm trying to encapsulate a very huge concept that you're just going to have to study about to get your own insights about. And I'm trying to capture it in capsules to give you some idea of where to look or how to look for answers about this. But trust me, if you will, when I say that whether it's tennis or short order cook, or motherhood, or the universe, or colonizing Mars, or how did the universe come about, particle physics. Wherever you go, whatever your natural penchant, ability, curiosity takes you, it all follows this process that Buddha described 2,700 years ago. It's here in the evolution of the universe. It's here in the evolution of universes. It's here in the evolution of how you cook a good pasta. It's here in the evolution of your experience from moment to moment, day to day, week to week. It's all Nidana. It's all 3,000 realms in a single moment, thought moment. It's all the three bodies of Buddha. Manifest reward, Dharma. Bing. Manifest desire, reward, take it to Gohanzon, Dharma, I understand. It's in everything. So I guess I'm done until I try to answer this question or one of them again. I hope you found this helpful. I tried to pursue this in a different way. I ended up touching on stuff I've said in the past, but I'm kind of entertained by my own analogies. The tennis one will stick with me for a little while, I think. And all of this comes about because you guys ask questions. You go in the comments section and what about this? What about that? Or you email me directly. And you force me to rethink things that I've been talking about. I've been doing this 40 years or more. So of course I evolve. I evolve moment to moment, week to week, month to month. And sometimes I look at some of my older videos and I go, I wish I wouldn't have said it that way, or I could have said that better.